Welcome to Elaine's. I'm Jeffrey Higgins. Really excited to have you here. We've turned Elaine's restaurant, which is my wife's restaurant. By the way, thank you all for eating. I see people eating and drinking. It's keeping us in business, allowing us to offer space free to authors. So it's a big help. But we've turned this into a literary salon. And I think this is the 121st author interview I've done since we've opened. But we partner with Mystery Writers of America and Sisters in Crime and lots of writing groups. We had a big writing conference, ShortCon, here last night. So it's really fun to be there and celebrate writing. If any of you are writers or know writers, just reach out to me via email. My cards are over here, and I'll be happy to find the time to celebrate your work. Because people don't realize how hard it is to write and publish a book. It's incredibly difficult. So it's almost as bad as running a restaurant.
Well, more difficult than writing is getting the book into the reader's hands.
Absolutely.
The marketing part, that's what's really hard.
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult and different skill sets.
Yeah, definitely.
So this will be a fun one. I'm looking forward to it. Christine Fowler Cassidy's was born and raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and was always interested that all her ancestors she could identify came from Germany. After reviewing her family genealogy and reflecting on some of her relatives' experiences, she was inspired to write Magda's story. Christine attended college and graduate school at Northwestern University and Princeton University, respectively. Now retired from her career as an economic policy analyst of international development for the World Bank, she volunteers with nonprofits supporting women and families. She especially enjoys reading and writing, travel, yoga, and sharing books with friends. She lives in Chevy Chase with her husband and sees their 4 children, 2 grandchildren, and 3 granddogs in the 4 corners of North America, from California, Texas, Canada, and D.C., as often as possible. Magda Standing is her first novel. A Telltale is her first, that doesn't really work, spoken. A Telltale is her first picture book for which grandson number 1 helped provide inspiration and critique. That's really cute. So please welcome Christine.
Thank you, Tom.
So this is a big divergence from what you were doing professionally for years.
It is. My job did involve a lot of writing, and I think I was used to writing all the time, revising a lot, which is good work, a good lesson for writers, because you have to revise your work. And having deadlines meant that I was kind of accustomed to, you know, being worth staying with it until I had a product. In that sense, it was similar. It was a very different move to do something that's creative writing. And that I was never certain I could do that. And so that's why I waited until retirement before I really attempted this serious effort.
Well, congratulations. You can do it. So we have proof right behind you. So why don't you tell us, what's Magda Standing about?
So Magda Standing is the story of a teenage girl in Pittsburgh in 1916 at the start of the story. And she's just finished her second year of high school with good marks. And her father tells her she has to stay home and take care of her invalid mother and little brother. And she's furious. She does have 2 maiden aunts who are teachers, and they tutor her and enable her and help her to finish her studies. At that point, the U.S. joins the First World War, what was called the Great War. And her family members get involved in that, and you have to read to find out what happens after that. She becomes a Red Cross volunteer, so that puts her closer to what's happening with the soldiers.
I have so many questions about this. So where did the idea come from? Let's start there.
Well, elements of the story came from family history. So my mother, when she was a teenager, had to take care of younger brothers because her mother was mentally ill. Her mother actually had electroshock therapy in the 30s, if you can imagine. She also had 2 maiden aunts who were school teachers who were really inspired her. But fortunately, she didn't have to leave school. and then another important element of story and inspiration was that in my family, 3 of the family members in my grandparents' generation died in the Spanish flu. My father's father died, and they were all young. They were in their 20s and 30s. And the loss of my grandfather with the 3 little kids at home was something that my grandmother talked about. She never really got over it. So those were elements of family lore that I always kind of thought it would be interesting to dig more into those. Unfortunately, I didn't interview family members while they were still around who could tell me more about it. I only had 1 surviving uncle who was very, very young, so he couldn't tell me too much about it. But those were the elements that started it. I've always enjoyed studying history, and I was always fascinated by the Spanish flu because it had such an effect on the family, because my mother's mother also lost two siblings from it. And in my research, also as I was coming up on the 100th anniversary of the Spanish flu, because it really hit hard in 1918, especially. So around 2018, there started to be documentaries and books and so on. So I absorbed all of that. And at the same time that happened, towards the end of the Great War, as they called it. So I was reading a lot of history of that time as well. And so things kind of came together. So talk about that.
When did you start writing this?
Well, it depends what I count as actually writing. The first writing was, I would say, I wrote an outline because I was used to writing policy reports, and you wrote outlines and you got outlines approved by committees, so I wrote an outline. I wrote some character sketches, and I wrote part of the first chapter, and that was after I had done some ancestry search to get more sense of where my relatives had come from. So that was around 2015 to 2017. And then I wrote a first draft of the first chapter, and then I did nothing for 2 years because I was kind of paralyzed. I said, I have no idea what I'm doing. I've always,
Welcome to being a writer.
yeah.
We all feel that.
But I've always read novels, but I thought, well, how do you actually form a plot? How do you actually create characters? And so I went back to school. I started taking classes. The Writer Center in Bethesda is a wonderful resource. And I also took classes online. This was also heading into the beginning of the COVID period, so a lot of the classes were online. So I took those classes, and there were instructors and other students, who would give feedback on something I would write. And so then I would start to get an idea that, okay, I think I can do this. And in one of those classes, it was really nice. The first day, I was remembering that when my kids were little and they would say, "Oh, I want to be an astronaut," and I would say, "Well, if you work really hard, you could be an astronaut." And the first day of the class, the instructor said, "Well, if you work really hard, you can be a novelist." And I thought, yes, I could do this.
So I'm curious if you like your family lore about the Spanish flu that like impacted you during the pandemic, because it sounds like you were still working on this project during the pandemic. Did it sort of amplify the fears and the past history?
Well, first of all, I have to say the pandemic for me in some ways was a godsend because the 2 years almost of not having many other activities, which was very bad for many people. I mean, it was very bad, but it did mean that I was kind of forced to sit and write because there wasn't a whole lot else to do. So I was ready. My research had kind of come up to that point. I was interested as there started to be talk about COVID becoming a pandemic. I was interested with the comparison because we were only 100 years away from the previous one, and there were a lot of articles that started to make the comparison. And so one of the things I did in my research was I actually looked at the data to compare the impacts. The 1918 pandemic was much, 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 much worse than COVID. And one of the reasons it was so much worse is that I think the whole world's population at that point, they'd been through this war, which had affected not only Northern Europe, but Southern Europe and Russia. And many people were malnourished. They were, in bad health. And the medical system was totally broken, such as it was. And so the deaths were very much, very much greater, very much higher. But it certainly put something in the back of my mind, as we were going into COVID, of thinking that there's a story of COVID too. I mean, there's going to be people writing about that too.
And so the theme of this, would you say like is it the immigrant experience is part of it? And if so, like how do you is that what you wanted to say when you first started writing?
Well, I definitely wanted to talk about the immigrant experience because that's where we all came, virtually all came from. My family came from Germany, and the German immigrants mostly came in around the late 1800s, and they were better off than many other immigrants because they tended to be literate, and they were able to do relatively well economically shortly after arriving. But as the First World War started, there was a lot of suspicion and strong feeling against Germans because there was a sense that, well, maybe they're saboteurs and spies and so on. And up to that point, there were 500 German language newspapers in the US. There were German churches everywhere. There were German taverns and community centers, and it was an extremely active group. And they kind of shut down and closed in on themselves to some extent. I remember my father saying, he was born in 1914, so he was too young to remember the First World War. But he remembered, as he was growing up as a child, still feeling very embarrassed, and that people, still felt, they resented the Germans because Germany had started this horrible war. So, and then of course it got worse in the Second World War. So there was that sensitivity about Germans. But I think the universal thing about immigration, of course, is that sense of trying to fit into a new society. And so that was an important theme. Another important theme I wanted to write about was about a girl striving for education to make something of herself other than simply giving in to society's expectations. And I think that's been the story for women since Eve, in different permutations, different forms. Sometimes it's been easier, sometimes it's more difficult. But that was very much a theme that I wanted to talk about as well. And then also family, the importance of family. In the story, the family is large, they're very close. At the same time, they're kind of suffocating. And in particular, it's because of the family, it's because of her obligations to her mother and her little brother that she is held back from what she wants to do. But she finds a workaround.
So those are all themes we can probably all relate to. What you said, are any of like your grandmother's stories or things that were passed down, are they in the book, like things that happened to her?
Well, unfortunately, I didn't interview either of my grandmothers because they were already passed by the time I seriously thought about this. But not specifically. I read a lot of other fiction. By the way, you may have noticed, and I'm sure everyone's noticed, that there are loads and loads and loads of stories of movies about World War II. Very much fewer about World War I. But I did try to absorb and read as many of those as I could. And so I picked up on some of those stories. I also read memoirs. I read letters from nurses who served during the Great War. And so those stories helped to give me the flavor of what they were experiencing and how they talked and what it was like there. But I couldn't really rely very much on my family stories because they weren't very, there was nothing terribly specific except for my grandfather's death.
So you mentioned character sketches. I'm always curious how people come up with their characters. Were these like ideas you thought about before, or were they specific to the book? You knew what you wanted to write about, and so you had to populate it with characters. Or tell us about your character creation.
Okay, well, the main character is Magda. She's 16 at the beginning of the story. And I would say, in a way, I thought of her kind of like my mother. I mean, my mother is a very determined sort of person. And I'm sure that I thought of her kind of as myself also. And I have three daughters, so I sort of knew what a teenage girl is like. And the two maiden aunts, I based them on my mother's aunts, who the way she described that they had passed away by the time I was old enough to really remember. But they were feisty, smart, very independent women. They were actually both school administrators, and never married. And they had their own house and their own car. And there were actually three sisters like that. And one of them was an entrepreneur. And so they, just the personalities of them and the way they were described by my mother. So they were definitely right there up front. And then I thought of my paternal grandfather, who was a strong Germanic character. And I thought of Papa in the story. I thought of him, my grandfather. So I would say that that's how I sort of started it. And some of the characters sort of came up, like for example, Richie, the little brother that she has to take care of. Around about that time, I had my first grandchild, first grandson. So he was kind of a role model for Richie. And so, so I drew that.
So you mentioned you're a part of the character. Do you find it difficult to think as the character when you're writing the stuff? Since everything you've kind of have this amalgam of people you know, right, that you put into it, but each character has to react differently to the conflict and things. So was that hard for you to get into the character, or does it take time?
Well, it does take time. Sometimes I had to try to not go with what was the first way of describing the character's behavior. Sometimes I would think, well, that's too easy what she's doing, or that's too obvious what she's doing, and I'd have to go back and make it a little more complex, But I did find maybe about halfway writing through it that I felt like I really knew my main characters well enough that I really knew what they were going to do and say in a scene. I didn't have to think about it that much. I had to think about what the scenes were going to be. What am I going to put them through next? But once I could think of a scenario, I thought, okay, I know exactly what Aunt Minnie is going to say in that situation, And that was kind of cool. It was like really they had at that point they had sort of come alive.
Do you ever have that moment where characters surprise you? Like a character does something you hadn't thought of, like, or you feel like it's coming from the character? That sounds weird, right? But it happens, trust me.
I think that's a good question. Well, when she decides to become a Red Cross volunteer, because she sees the recruitment office and they're looking for Red Cross volunteers. And I'm not sure how that scene came to me, but I thought, yeah, she would do that. She decided to do that, And so there were some things like that where I'd get a general framework of a scene, and then I would realize the character is going to do it in a certain way, So I don't know if that's fully the answer to your question.
No, I love it. It's perfect. So characters have to change, right? There has to be ways that the plot affects them and they change internally. Do you plot that stuff out like for the character arc, or is this like do you, how do you think of character change from the beginning to the end?
That's a really important question. Well, in some ways, because I was writing this story where it starts the year before the US joins the Great War, and I had to structure it so that she would finish her studies and have time to get into the war setting. So, like, the US joined in 1917. The war had already been raging for 3 years in Europe. I had to find a way. Originally, I was thinking she was going to be all focused on continuing her studies and going to college and stuff like that. But then I figured, no, there isn't time for that. She's going to get involved with this war. But I didn't want to take her all the way over to Europe and have to research all these battles and all that kind of thing, And one editor said to me, well, it would be exciting if you took her onto the battlefield, And I said, no, this is not a book about the First World War. This is a book about the impact of the war on the family back home. So, but I had to make it work out so that things would happen to her that would bring the war to closer to the story and closer to her family. And similarly with the flu.
How do you balance that when you're bringing in information about a war and you're trying to be historically accurate? How do you balance that with like pacing? You know, when you're trying to keep tension in the book, and especially like you talked about this happening like over years, and I'll start earlier, and like is that difficult when you have a long time frame?
Well, I started the story where she was going to be at the beginning of high school, so there was going to be almost 4 years before the U.S. joined the war. And an editor told me that that's way too dragged out. So have it only 1 year before the war so that there could be a stronger pace to it. As far as like how you bring in the factual background, because when you're writing almost any kind of fiction, but particularly historical fiction, there's a lot of factual background you have to give your readers. And you don't want to just suddenly make it sound like a history book. So I had to put little bits of it, like, so for example, from the beginning, the family was very much aware and very concerned about the fact that the war was happening in Europe and that it was Germany that was leading the Axis, and they were very anxious about that. They were anxious because of what everyone thought about them. And so I could put certain facts into it there. I could have people, I could have the characters talking about it. I could have the character reading the newspaper. But I was telling the story always from her perspective. So that meant that this is what I learned from the instructors, that when you're writing what's called third person close, where the story is from the perspective of one character, you can only provide information that that character knows, that that character learns, that that character hears about in the story. So I couldn't suddenly throw in a lot of facts just for the sake of informing the reader. It had to be as Magda was learning these things. So that was kind of, that took maneuvering and to learn that as I went along.
Did you have like a principle to determine what facts you find? So I'm sure you've come across a lot of interesting things. How did you know when to include it or when not to?
Well, one of the things, by the way, was I said the family was German, and it's set in Pittsburgh, where I grew up, and that was one of the cities that had a lot of German population. And I came across the German American Heritage Museum, which is downtown, a little museum. It's in Chinatown, actually. And they have some archives there that include artifacts from German immigrants, and also some books. And so I got some of the books from there, and I read about more about, aspects of lifestyle at the time, but also they had a very nice collection of analysis about what Germans contributed to American society in all across all things, medicine and culture and science and so on. And so I read up about that, and then what was kind of fun was sprinkling some of those facts into the story. Obviously Germans were very big, breweries, for example. They were very well known for breweries. I mean, that was too obvious actually to mention. But learning about how important the German culture was at that time, the 500 newspapers, 500 German language newspapers were circulated in the US. So that was really interesting to be able to sprinkle some of those facts in there. And sometimes I would just come across things that, were totally by accident. Like I was reading this one thing in this book, and it said that the snaps that we have on our clothes to replace buttons, that was invented in Germany. And one of the characters has lost an arm and uses the snaps to on his clothing. And I just thought that was kind of cool. Of course he's used snaps because the Germans invented them and he needs them. So, and it just fit into the story right at that moment. So
Was there
that was
anything
fun.
really surprising that you found, or something that changed a previous idea that you had about this era?
Really surprising. Well, one of the things that I learned in my research is that it was an era of real technological change. And it's not like today's technological change, but it was big technological change. So for example, reading about how important it was that in that period of the 1910s and early 1920s, vacuum cleaners and washing machines and toasters and Victrolas and movies and motion pictures, as I called them, and of course cars, all these things started to become popular. I mean, telephones, you know, not everyone could afford them, but everyone desired them, and they were becoming more popular. And this was making a tremendous difference to the women's labor in particular. And so that was giving a more of an opportunity for women to get out, you know, or at least shed some of the domestic work they had. And then, of course, reading about the war, that technological change, unfortunately, just, you know, literally blew up in the course of that war, because that's where they introduced tanks and poison gas and bomb, aerial bombing and mining of the seas. These things that unfortunately became perfected and perfected, but they started then. So learning about all that technology was really striking. And I do think it was an intense period of technological change.
Writers who work in historical fiction often have a difficulty when they're trying to balance the research versus the writing, and mm-hmm. because it's so interesting, mm-hmm. but also it's an avoidance technique, right? Did you find that, and did you have to stop yourself from going too deep in some of these areas?
Yeah, well, people talk about it as the rabbit hole. You go down the research rabbit hole, and it very often happens that I sit down and say, okay, I'm gonna write a scene today. And then I think, oh, okay, I need to check on this one thing. So I go on to, you know, right away I go on to Google and I check something. And then, of course, next thing I know, I'm here and I'm there and I'm there and I'm there and I'm there. And, you know, 2 hours have gone and I haven't gone back to the text. So that's a real risk. But what I've tried to do is I kind of try to have research days and writing days. And the research is really fun. That's where you get a lot of the ideas. A lot of them come from that.
So I want to ask you a little bit about, like, this is your debut novel. You have a picture book too that I'd like to talk about, mm-hmm. but your debut novel, how did that feel? Was it traditionally published?
No, it was, well, first of all, I did the usual routine. I sent query letters out to dozens and dozens and dozens of traditional publishers. Traditional publishers mean, you know, that you usually go through an agent who tries to sell your book to a publisher, and there's no money exchange with the author until it's sold. If it's sold, and then if you get royalties. That's basically the routine, traditional. And I'm told that about 2% of books that are sent to it through that route get published.
I think it's way less than that.
Okay. So that, what does that tell you? So then I found out, actually quite serendipitously, about this other option. Oh, and then of course there's self-publishing, you know about self. But I didn't want to do that because I had no idea how to publish. And I didn't want to get into having to find all these things myself, and I didn't want it to come out looking amateur either. So I found out about hybrid publishing. Hybrid publishing is literally in the middle. And the way it works is that you pay up front for professional services from an individual publisher who has the professional staff to do the editing, the design, and the production. And the big difference is you pay a lump sum fee up front, but you know what you're getting. And if it's a good company, and the two I've used were very good companies, they provided excellent service, and then I also get a higher royalty rate than the traditional publishers. So that was what I did for that. Yeah.
So when they produce the book and then they send you your copies, tell us about, like, that moment when you open the box and you get to see your book, something that's been in your head for years at this point. What did that feel like?
It was a heavy box. And I think the first time it came through Amazon, actually, because Amazon was printing it. It's printed on demand, like most books are nowadays. And I was thinking, what did you order from Amazon? It was so big. So it was, yeah, it's really cool to open it up.
Was there any, like, trepidation knowing that, okay, your book is here, it's out in the world now, and people you don't know are reading it? Does that create any nervousness?
Well, yeah, although most of that nervousness was before the actual publication. As I've told some of my friends, I did not tell anybody, including my husband, that I was writing this book until I was more than halfway through it. Now, most of this was during the pandemic, and he was doing his he's he writes and publishes articles and things too. So he was busy in his office doing his writing, and I was busy in my office doing my writing. And he didn't ask me about it. I mean, I had all these books about the First World War piled on my desk, but he didn't ask. And I didn't tell anybody because I did not trust myself. I thought, this is a crazy lark. There's no way I'm going to be able to do this. And I don't want people asking me, how's it coming? How's it coming? So I waited until I was easily halfway into it, and I knew I was going to be able to do it. And then I started telling him. And when I told my husband, he laughed. He didn't believe it either. And my kids also, they're like, Mom, really? So that was, but the first time people read it and kind of said, yeah, this dog can hunt, and then and I got good responses. That was really cool.
Hiding it from people is more common than you'd think.
Isn't
I
it
was talking
different?
to Freda McFadden, told me that she hadn't told anyone, her family, her children, anybody, until the book came out, and then it became a bestseller. And she's like, at this point, I have to tell somebody,
Really?
because everybody kind of has that fear.
Well, because once many years ago, I had in mind I was going to write a book, and I told one friend, and that friend would say to me, "So, how's it coming?" And I wasn't doing anything, and I got so embarrassed, and I said, "I'm just not going to get into this situation again."
So now that it's out there, how do you deal with like reviews and criticism? And it's a different thing, right? To hear people talking about the ideas that have been in your head for all these
Yeah,
years, and now
yeah.
they're there to give their opinion on it.
Well, happily, it's been I've gotten. I mean, the feedback that I've heard, that I've been told, has been quite good. And I wrote the book actually as a young adult novel. Young adult is a marketing genre, typically aimed at teens. And I aimed it for that because of the teen protagonist. And the interesting thing, though, is that at this point of my life, I don't have much contact with teens. My kids are much older. My grandchildren are much younger. And I realized after saying this is a young adult book that I don't know any young adults. So that was kind of awkward because I tried to find out, okay, who I know that has somebody who's a teen and try to get feedback from them, and they were kind of too shy or too busy or something to give me feedback on that. So it's been kind of tough reaching that audience, except I have managed to do some school visits in middle school and high school. And those have been very nice. And the kids have been receptive, although in most cases they hadn't read the book beforehand. So I was telling them about the writing. So that's been a bit tough, actually, reaching that age group.
So you can research slang, and you can go to schools and see what they're doing and what clothes they're wearing and that type of thing. But getting your head inside of an undeveloped mind is different, right? And how much of it do you remember from when you were young? Being in, is it hard to put yourself back in that mindset? And was it hard to write in the mind of this character?
Well, I do have four kids and three of them daughters, and I think it helped that I had, a reasonably fresh memory of how they were. But it's funny, in the first draft of it, one of the comments I got back was that I didn't have enough teenage angst. I mean, Magda was too mature, and I didn't have enough other teen friends in the story, that I needed to have more of that. I needed to have more peer relationships and peer drama and so forth. So that I had to spend some time thinking about, because for me it was much easier to write, one teen character and then a bunch of adults. So that took some thinking.
So you talk about like teenage angst, but how is that different in 2025 compared to the beginning of the last century, right? I mean, I'm sure kids had a very different outlook at that point. Were you able to find that through your research?
I mean, and not specifically research on teenagers back then, but I mean, I do know from my own upbringing in a fairly strict German culture was that, certain things like you don't talk back to your parents, you don't talk back to adults. You have to be very restrained in the way you dress, in the way you behave around the adults, and when you talk to them. So that kind of more stronger stricture of behavior was something that drew upon, because that's what I believe to be the case, particularly in a family like mine. But I think the other big difference is in the family in the story, there are eight children in the family, of which two died as babies. But it's a big family, and the family, they're very close, and they take care of each other a lot. And that, I think, is a feature that has always been true in the past. You don't see it as much nowadays. And so I came from a family of four, but I was very familiar with larger families where the older kids still care of the younger kids. And that's kind of a cultural thing that, at least I think for many people, frankly, of our socioeconomic background, we don't see it quite as much. So that's something that I drew on from, you know, from knowing of references like that.
So other than the age of your protagonist, what makes this young adult? And like, what are some of the restrictions and tropes that you have to follow?
Well, okay. So typically a young adult novel is a coming of age. It's a coming of age. So it's about the young person's first realization of who they want to be, of resistance, some independence from family, resistance and some independence effort from family. Getting out of the family to some degree. I mean, at the end of the story, she's 19, so she's somewhat more independent at that point. So that's a big thing. Also, young adult novels typically don't have explicit sex. I mean, it's first love. First love is a big part of it, but not. Not what you'd expect from, or if you turn on the TV. It's not what's on the TV.
And so your picture book is for younger children, right? Well, what is the age range for that?
That's ages 4 to 8.
And when did you write that book?
Well, this is interesting. So I wrote that story originally my senior year in high school. I wrote it as a skit. And it was initially just a story. But about a little boy who is fascinated by the tails that animals have, and he wants to try on different tails. That was the story. And I just put it aside, and decades go by. And so this book had come out, and I was cleaning out a closet where I had an envelope of high school and college papers. I had not cleaned my closet in several decades. And I found this yellowed paper with this basic story in it. So I thought, hey, I know something about publishing, so I'm going to go back to this story. So I had a published children's author read it, a couple of them. And they said, well, and I said, okay, you know, it's a whimsical story. A kid wants to try on a tail. End of story. The end. And they said, no. Even for children's picture books, you have to have some problem that the protagonist is dealing with. You still have to have an arc. You have to have an arc of the story and an arc of the character. And so I went back again and I took some classes in children's picture book writing. And after several revisions, the story is quite different now, but it's still about, it's about a little boy who starts his school. He's not finding friends. He's feeling bullied. And he's feeling very put upon, and this magical tailor comes into his life and tells him, you know, well, why don't you try on some tails? And this sounds really silly. It is a silly story, but it has some moral about standing up for yourself, making friends, developing empathy. And one of the main characters is a snake who is all tail. And the snake is very wise, and the snake... Well, I don't want to tell you all about it, but the snake is more vulnerable than the little boy is, and he realizes that. And so he becomes friends with the snake.
You know, all fairy tales and children's books, when you describe them, sound silly, but it doesn't mean the story is silly, right? So how is a picture book different? I mean, obviously, you just mentioned the arc that has to be there, yeah, and the conflict and everything. But how is it different when you're incorporating pictures throughout the story?
Well, first of all, I'm not an illustrator, so... I had to find an illustrator through a publisher, which is what I did, and she's terrific. So one of the things is they tell you nowadays that children's picture books should be under 500 words. That is a tough restriction. And, the novel is actually 96,000 words. And so when I first drafted the picture book, I had it was like 2,500 words. And I thought, okay, well, that's really succinct. But they said, nope, you got to get it down. So and reasonably enough, the pictures are supposed to tell a lot of the story. And making that judgment was really tough. Letting go of text is really tough at any point, as you know. So I actually got it down to about 720. I didn't totally get it below 500.
720 is incredibly short. Like, it's shorter than the average newspaper article.
And even now, I realize that there are things that I didn't have to say that could have been done in the pictures. But one of the things, if you're not an author illustrator, you're putting your book in the hands of someone who's going to be treating it with a totally different modality, right? And one thing I learned about traditional publishers is if they buy your picture book text, they will get an illustrator. And you may have absolutely no say in what that illustrator does, which I thought was incredible. I thought, well, at the very least, it should be a partnership, right? So again, I was really fortunate that after getting all those rejections from the traditionals, I found another hybrid publisher who has a roster of illustrators, and I picked one of them based on her work. I liked her work. And it was wonderful. I mean, from the beginning, she said to me, well, like, how do you picture this character? And we talked about that. And how do you picture the next character? And then she would send me each of the pages. And she was very open to my suggestions. Sometimes I said, no, she's right. It should be that way. And other times she took my suggestion. So, for example, I wanted the children in the story to look racially diverse. She agreed with that. The magical character of the tailor, the first time she drew him, he was like very dark skinned. And I said, no, I don't want him to be dark skinned. He's magical, but I don't want him to look that much other. He's a little bit more like one of us. And I actually wrote a sequel to it that's coming out in September because one of the first drafts, I had the boy trying on like five or six tails. And the editor said, or the author who was advising me about it said, that's too many. You got to stick it with three. There's something about the magic. Three is a magical number. People can only remember three things, right?
It's a rule of threes.
A rule of three. I remember in the World Bank when we wrote reports, they would say, you have three messages. Your reader's not going to remember more than three messages. So I could only use three tails. So I had to write it on the book for the other tails. And in that book, I had the same illustrator. She was even better in the second book. And there was this one scene where there's a veterinarian, and they were men in the story, but I wanted another woman, so I asked her if she would make the veterinarian a woman, and she redrew it. So it was wonderful. It really was. And I just think that really that she's so responsible for.
Were you nervous before you saw that first picture?
Was very nervous going with an illustrator that I didn't know. Yeah. But from the very beginning, when she asked me from the beginning, how do I visualize the character, And so I knew that we were going to be talking about this, and it was just very comfortable.
So you mentioned having a story back in school. Like, what was the first time you knew you wanted to be a writer?
I always had the thought that I wanted to be a writer, but I wasn't working on it in the right way, in a way. Like, I can't remember having creative writing classes in school. And I remember my dad wrote poetry, and I would write a little bit of poetry, nothing worth remembering. So I would do a little bit of that, and he always encouraged writing. But I never thought of myself as creative. I thought of myself as an institutional writer. I just didn't think I had the creativity in me. To make
Even
up.
after all those tales.
Well, but this is before the test. This is before the test. I mean, and the reason I drafted it the first time in high school was probably a school assignment. I don't remember exactly, but I honestly don't remember taking writing classes in school. I mean, creative writing classes. But I was a big daydreamer, and I made up stories in my head. So I always had stories in my head.
I think that's common with all storytellers. Do you remember the first time a story captivated you, like when you were young, whether it was a book or a show or a movie?
Well, I was totally in love with Little House in the Big Woods, that whole series. I read the whole thing again to my kids. I'm sure there were ones earlier than that that I can't cite specifically, but when I was a teenager, I read every Nancy Drew book. I look at all the women nodding. Do you remember? Do you know what Nancy Drew?
Not only do I know of it, but almost every writer I've talked to said it was either Hardy Boys or Nancy Drew that inspired them. Almost every
you
single
too.
One, even younger writers.
But you grew up in India, right?
Yeah.
And you knew?
No, not then. I came to read them later.
Yeah.
When I came to the U.S. But in India, we used to read it as black. And they had a very different set of famous spies and things like that.
Yeah.
Some of that time
was yeah.
Habit.
And my dad would get so upset, I should be reading the classics. You know, he'd see me reading a Nancy Drew book under the covers at night. He'd say, you should be reading the classics. Well, I don't think I ever read the classics voluntarily. But there's something, oh, okay. But so many women, especially of our generation, we were inspired by Nancy Drew. You know, Sandra Ginsberg said she credits Nancy Drew with her, you know, with her early reading, because it was a independent character who did things for herself, and she just, you know, she inspired us in that way. And the books had good plots, yeah. And the characters, you know, the characters never changed much. There were just a few characters in it, but they were engrossing. I read one after the other.
But where is it that you think story comes from? And I ask every author this one question, because it's interesting to hear the answers. You know, it's coming out of your head, but
yeah.
How? How did that story get formed? Something that's never existed.
Well, I think if we knew that, that would be a $1 million question.
I'll take like $20.
Where does story come from? Well, I mean, I think it had to do with piecing together elements of story. You know, as I mentioned, some of the family background. I just kind of pieced them together. It was sort of like a jigsaw puzzle. You know, when you're doing a jigsaw puzzle, you can get a section and you see that. And then, but then you think, yeah, but what does that connect to? And then another section. Well, what does that connect to? And then at some point, you can see how they connect. That's the best analogy I could think of.
No, I like it. It's great. So I'm going to go to unanswered questions in just a second, but I want to ask you just some really quick rapid fire questions here on your process, because I ask writers that. It's different for everybody.
Yeah.
Do you, where do you write?
Usually in my bedroom where I have a desk.
Can you write anywhere?
I write pretty well on airplanes if I'm on a long flight. And if I can plug in my computer, and if I have enough leg room, and preferably in business class, but I haven't flown business class since I've been retired, actually. But there's something about the air on airplanes. I don't know what it is. It affects me. I do good writing on airplanes. I really do.
There's less oxygen.
Maybe that's it. And also, I like to sit near the window where I'm absolutely stuck. You know, I can't do anything else. Unless, of course, they're showing a million movies, and that's bad.
Do you write at a certain time of day?
No. Usually early afternoon, I would say.
Do you listen to music, or can you listen to anything?
No, I've never done anything like that. I'm very, very, very distractible. Oftentimes people ask, do I have to write every day? Right. Somebody told me, I was with this other author, and his alarm went off. It was 3 in the afternoon. He said, oh, that's my writing alarm. I'm supposed to be sitting at my desk writing now. And I thought, that's not me. I don't do that. But, I mean, what I do is I'd say I think about it every day. I think about the scene and what's going to happen. Is I can't sit down and write if I don't have any idea what's coming next.
I would say that thinking about it counts as writing every day. The thinking's a big part of writing a book.
Yeah, visualizing. Visualizing and sometimes you realize when you're thinking like that, you realize that you have to go back and change a previous scene in order to make a new scene work, right? And so I think the thinking about it is really productive time. Yeah.
So how many editing iterations do you go through?
I don't even know how to count that. I could say more how many editors I went through. So first of all, after I finished the last page, I sent it to two people who had been in a writing group with me and who agreed to read it all the way through very kindly. And I made some changes based on their feedback. And then I hired a professional editor who was a published young adult author, and she went through it thoroughly. She gave me markup and pages of comments, and she suggested some significant changes. I mean, nothing that was horrible, painful to do, but important work changes. And that took me probably 2 months to put all of those changes in. After I found my publisher, she has an excellent editor who did another thorough round on it, not as deeply. So, like, there's the developmental editing where they look at your structure and your pacing and so forth. And then she went through it a little bit more on character, and she also checked me on all the historical stuff. She found a very important anachronism that I'm glad I fixed before it was published. I would have been caught in a big faux pas. Because, you do your historical research, but then sometimes you miss things. So, for example, I wanted to include the fact that, I said my grandmother had electroshock therapy. That was in the 30s. And I was having Mama, who had, I never said in the book what was wrong with Mama's mental illness, because people didn't give names for things really back then. But she was institutionalized, as my grandmother was, and I was going to have her get electroshock therapy. And then the editor pointed out that, and I had researched this, I don't know how I made this mistake, but it wasn't offered back that early. It hadn't been developed that early. So there are things like that, that could get. And then we went over it again, thoroughly, thoroughly, every line for the line editing, and then for the proofing. And what's tough too is when the editors mark with mark up all of this, you have to, as the author, go over every one of their comments and approve or disapprove, and really do it carefully, because things can slip in that you didn't intend, that you don't want, and maybe they didn't intend, but things, right? And then you have to worry about which version you're dealing with and making sure that you're putting the changes on the right version and not the old version. So that's a tough period.
How do you decide when an editor's comment is worth taking?
Well, I guess if it's something that, your first reaction is, oh, well, I don't want to do that. But then if you can talk to them about it and find out, why do you say this? And, if they're saying something like, the pacing is lagging here, it's getting boring right in here, you have to take them seriously. Even if you don't think it's boring, you have to take them seriously. And I was just in a Zoom with a writer's group this week, and one of the new authors was saying how painful it was getting back the comments from the editor. And she said, but I know she has my best interest at heart. And I said, well, actually, she doesn't have your best interest as a writer. She has the reader's best interest at heart. And sometimes you have to accept that. That can be tough. But there were other times when I just plain didn't agree, and I made my case for it. Sometimes we disagree to disagree, but I would say the vast majority of changes I accepted.
All right, last question, and then I'll go to audience questions. Anybody has anything? Do you like writing the process itself, or do you like having written? Which is more fulfilling for you, to have that book over there or when you're actually doing it?
Having written, surely.
Yeah.
But the other thing I find interesting, and I used to find this even in my institutional writing, as I call it, is that when you sit down to write something, ideas come to you in the process of writing. And I'm sure that all of you have written and all of you have experienced this. You're writing and suddenly the words come together sometimes in a way you had not anticipated. And that is really neat when that happens. It doesn't happen all the way. It doesn't happen enough. But there are times when, you know, I really surprised myself that, hey, what I said, you know, I didn't know I was going to be able to say that.
It's a little bit of the magic.
It's magic to it, yeah.
All right, I'm going to come around. Just raise your hand. I'll ask you to speak into the microphone so it comes out on the recording.
So you're doing three books. One yet to be revealed. What's next?
Well, this is a big question. Like, do I reveal?
I know.
Or, you know, because then people are saying, oh, "How's it coming? How's it coming?" I spent a lot of time trying to think about writing another novel, and I had like three ideas in my head. Different. I like historical fiction, so that's what I'm most inspired by. So I had like three different time periods, three different situations, and I started to research each one of them. And finally, I settled on writing a sequel to Magda. So I'm working on that now. I'm about halfway through it, but I'm having a much harder time with this one because with the first one, I kind of knew where it was going. I knew it was leading to the war and the flu, you know. And so I had, from the very beginning, I knew where the story was going. So I'm having a harder time with this one.
Other questions over here?
Yes.
Will you use the same editors and illustrators for your next book?
Well, the next picture book is with the same publisher and the same illustrator. And in fact, as soon as I finished the sequel, I went immediately to the same publisher and I said, I want to book that illustrator right away so that, you know, she can't get away, because I knew I had to have the same one. And so, I mean, if I finish the sequel, I'll probably go to the same publisher, but I don't want to jinx myself by making too many promises that way. But she's been one. My publisher of this of the novel is a woman who had a career with Random House in New York for 35 years. And then she moved down to this area and opened her own publishing house for women writers. And she's been in business for about 7 years. At this point, she's published about 36 books. And she has very, very good people working for her. And they're wonderful to work with. And we're kind of a group that we exchange a lot of ideas together. And it's been really nice. And so the women authors, many of them are memoirists. Many of them have written nonfiction. There's a lot of nonfiction, some fiction, some other fiction too.
Other questions over here?
When you start writing, do you sometimes, like, do you know the ending of the book? Like, do you have something in your head about how you want the story to end as you even begin the writing?
Yeah.
That's what I'm asking.
Yeah. I definitely do. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, that it can't change, but I mean, one of the first questions I've been struggling over is I've tried to figure out what to do with the sequel. And even with the first ones, I ask myself, why would anybody bother to read this? What are they going to get out of it? What are they going to take away? And I try to map out the plot always, because I mean, it's partly because that's the way I wrote for years in my job. You know, I would write a full outline. And in the various writing classes, they tell you, well, there's plotters and there's pantsers. Plotters write plots and pantsers write by the seat of their pants. And maybe some people can do the latter, but I'm sure you've sometimes read books where the book's kind of going, you know, and then suddenly something, it sort of ends, you know. And I know that if I were to do that approach, I would probably have a lot more revision to do. So it seems to me that approximately knowing how it's going to end, although I am struggling with that on this one, this new one.
Right. So where's the best place for readers to find you?
Well, I'm starting to hire somebody to help me with social media because I don't use social media, but they say that's where you should sell books. I have a website, which is on the card there. And on the website, I try to keep it really up to date with what I'm doing, the various events I'm doing. And also I put on the website some of the articles, some of the interesting background articles I used in my historical research, questions for book clubs, that there, questions for students. And it's available, it can be bought online from any bookseller because it's on Ingram, which is the big distributor, and of course Amazon, needless to say.
What is your website?
My website is ChristineCassidisAuthor.com.
And you have books here for sale, right? In case you want to get a book and get it signed?
Yeah, I do. So the novel is $20, $19.99, but no one uses pennies anymore. And the picture book is $17.99, call it 18. And I can take a credit card, Venmo, or cash, or check.
Well, I want to thank everybody for coming. Really appreciate supporting our authors. If you could do two things. One, go on Amazon and leave her a review. It really helps with sales when people can see a number of reviews there so they know other readers have enjoyed the work. And if you like what we're doing with our literary salon, if you do that for Elaine's too on Google or Yelp or wherever you rate restaurants, it makes a big deal. It would really help. Thank you so much. It's been really lovely.
Thanks so
Congratulations.
Much. Thank you.